Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Chabon has a knack for telling big, sometimes heartbreaking, often impactful stories through pop culture. The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay used the history and tropes of comics. The Final Solution wrapped a tale around the mysteries of Sherlock Holmes. Now he goes inside the world of the record store with his latest called Telegraph Avenue. The book is full of music, so much music that the ebook even comes with a playlist that includes this track. Michael Chabon, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
So what are we listening? Who is Deodato?
Deodato is a Brazilian composer, keyboard player, arranger. He had his heyday in the early to mid-1970s. He's probably best known. That track is called Superstrut.
Right.
It's a great track, and the amazing guitar work by John Tropea on that track on lead guitar. But Deodato was probably best remembered for his very jazzy, funky cover of the theme from 2001 that also Sprach Zarathustra.
The 2001 Space Odyssey.
Right, and
theme.
If you've seen the movie Being There, it's used to incredibly great effect in that film when Chauncey Gardner first walks out into the world. That's what's playing. And
can I tell you, as a little kid, I accidentally discovered David Bowie because I bought Space Oddity thinking I was buying Deodato's.
That's hilarious.
2001 Space
Odyssey. I wonder
how
many sales that accounted for of Major Tom.
One.
It's an easily made mistake.
So, but this is, I mean, this is part of the kind of soundtrack of this epic story that is a very intimate epic. I mean, it's centered around Brokeland Records on Telegraph Avenue in the East Bay,
right,
in Northern California. How much of a real place is this based on?
Well, in a way, it's a very idealized sort of amalgam of a number of different establishments that have come and gone over the years since I first moved to Berkeley in 1997. The direct initial inspiration came one day about 1999 or so when I walked into a record store I hadn't been in before called Berrigan's that was on Claremont Avenue. It was a small store, not as spacious and as quite a great of a hangout as the record store in my book. It was smaller, but the day that I walked in there, there were two guys working there, and one was white and one was black, and there were a bunch of guys hanging out, talking, or came in and went, and they had little conversations, and there was a vibe of conversation going in that store, and the people were themselves, the customers were black and white, and nobody was really buying too many records. They seemed to be mostly hanging out and talking and just shooting the breeze and gossiping. And, you know, I was just really struck by the way in this very tiny little microcosm, some black people and some white people seem to have figured out a way to just hang out together and talk about the things that they care about. And that triggered a powerful response in me, I think, principally because I grew up in a town called Columbia, Maryland. That was a planned community that was built between Baltimore and Washington in the 1960s. And it was planned, it was designed and constructed around very, you know, 1960s enlightened great society kind of principles. It was intended to be racially integrated. I grew up thinking the world was like that. You know, when I left Columbia, I rapidly, very rapidly discovered the world is not like that.
Yeah.
And it never was like that again until the day I walked into that record store. And even though that was just a store and not a city, it still chimed for me. It made me remember Columbia, and it made me see how far I had gone afield from the kid I was at age 8. I had lost, black people had once been very visible in my life, and they had become invisible, and I was looking for a way to try to make them visible again.
Now, you remember back in the 70s, that was sort of the end of when radio would play black and white artists.
Yes.
You would hear Stevie Wonder followed by the Rolling Stones, followed by whatever.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that's part of why the 70s are very much the touchstone decade for this book, for the people in this book.
I just want to say it's not set in the
70s. No, it's set in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys who work in this record store specialize in this, the music like we were just listening to, the Deodato, the stuff that was on CTI Records and Blue Note in the 70s. And which in itself was a very much the product of the interaction between black artists, white composers and black composers and arrangers and engineers. And part of what still continues to appeal to me about the music of that period is the way in which it seemed to not just cross over boundaries, but to completely ignore them.
Well, it's not just that the music in the novel, and again, the book is called Telegraph Avenue by my guest Michael Chabon, it's not just that the music is the pop figures that you're referencing. I mean, yes, Stevie Wonder and some of the prog rock of the 70s right. get shout-outs, mm-hmm. but the heart and soul of the lives of these people is this kind of soul jazz right. of the early 70s. Now, did you grow up with that, or did you have to research
No,
this?
I mean, well, it turned out I did grow up with it, but I just didn't know it. It was almost like that character in Molière who has been speaking prose his whole life and didn't know it. You know, I didn't know there was a name for this music like that Diodato. You know, it formed part of a continuum of music that started out being called hard bop in the 50s, came to be known as soul jazz. The music transformed over those years and then ultimately kind of ended its greatest incarnation as jazz funk, and what it all really means is music played by jazz musicians, but with the backbeat pushed really centrally into a position of prominence in the music. There was this movement that arose in the 50s among black musicians to restore the gospel roots, the blues roots to the music, and hard bop. The first hard bop album is usually viewed as having been Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers' mm-hmm. first album. From that period, what you can see that I think makes the music really fun, especially the music from the late 60s and early 70s, is that this was music performed by musicians aware of what was going on in popular music around right. them, and especially black popular music.
And sometimes, as with Mongo Santa Maria or Herbie Hancock, they would actually cross over and become popular.
Right.
But more often, they sort of fell into this deep well of obscurity from which occasionally they're rescued by crate divers and people like you, Michael.
Right.
So
hip-hop has been very instrumental in
exactly,
doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these completely obscure records, we hear their breaks, those
exactly.
drum breaks.
And that was the other thing, the reason I discovered I did know it. I had grown up with it. And, you know, especially the big period for hip-hop for me was like from the late 80s through the mid-90s, just before the Wu-Tang Clan era, the Biggie and Tupac era. I sort of lost touch with hip hop around then. But that intermediate era is when people like, you know, Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest and the guys in De La Soul, and they were really digging deep into a lot of this material. But I just didn't know that. When I heard these things, I thought, I recognize that. That was in a Tribe Called Quest song, or that was in a Organized Confusion song. But it turned out I knew more about it than I thought I did.
So one of the pieces on the playlist that comes with the ebook version of Telegraph Avenue is Manziel and the Midnight Theme.
Yeah.
I have never heard of Manziel, but
do you recognize it?
I sure
right?
do.
Especially that initial break, right? That's like
from 3 Feet High and Rising,
right.
That classic record from De La Soul. You might recognize it as well, but this is the original from the band Manziel. Midnight Theme by Manziel, a tune that was later sampled by De La Soul on their 1989 album 3 Feet High and Rising, but this original appears on the playlist that accompanies the ebook version of Michael Chabon's new novel, Telegraph Avenue. The book is centered around a used record store that specializes, Michael, not just in vinyl, but in this kind of vinyl.
Right.
It's a little, I mean, people will who haven't read the book will think, well, Nick Hornby, you know, High Fidelity, the 1995 book.
Great book.
And
great
effectively
movie too.
Turned into
yes.
a movie as well. But was there any inspiration there or?
You know, I read the book right when it came out and I really loved it. And I, same goes for the movie. And I still think that's one of Jack Black's best performances ever. But the situation of the guys who work in the store in my book is, and the reasons that they work in a record store, they do overlap to a certain degree. I mean, they overlap to the degree that they are like the characters in Nick Hornby's book. They love the music.
Right.
And it's the thing they love most in the world. But other than that, I mean, they're older. In the case of Nat Jaffe, he's married. He has a kid. They're in a different position in life. They're actually in more of a position where maybe it's time for them to start making some more serious choices.
Yeah.
It's not just about which girl's the girl for me anymore for these guys. It's more like, are you really going to keep doing this for the rest of your life, or is it time to get serious?
Especially with the encroachment of a huge record chain, which is moving in down the block and,
right.
you know, has a lot of money and a very famous ex-NFL player behind it.
So and a progressive social agenda, too.
Right.
They're trying to, like, improve this down-at-heel neighborhood and bring some needed community pride because it's a black-owned chain and they're going to be employing a lot of local people. It's this horrible thing that's happening to Nat and Archie in their store, but for everybody else it looks like a great blessing. So it really puts them on the wrong foot.
We're speaking with the author Michael Chabon, Pulitzer Prize winning writer and novelist. His new book is called Telegraph Avenue. He's with us in the Soundcheck studio. When you're writing, generally, do you listen to music?
Always.
And what kind of, I mean, what we've been listening to so far has been instrumental.
Yeah, and pretty much has to be instrumental. I can listen to vocal music if the lyrics are in a foreign language that I don't know at all sometimes, but even that can get a little intrusive. It's much better if it's instrumental. And then weirdly, for some reason, I can listen to like Tales from Topographic Oceans.
That is weird.
I know, or Relayer, maybe because the lyrics make no sense whatsoever. I know it so well, I don't really hear the lyrics anymore. And there's a few other bits like that where it's vocal, but it does. The ideal piece of music for writing for me is Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians, which has everything that music ideally would have to be good writing music for me. It's propulsive. It's instrumental. I mean, there are vocals, but they just are sounds. They sound like instruments. It is dynamically stable, and that's kind of the most important thing because I can't work when the music's constantly getting quieter and louder, quieter, louder. That I find that very distracting, and Music for 18 Musicians is very steady in that way. It fades perfectly into the background, but not all the way into the background, and it stays at just enough level of consciousness that it helps me to sort of shut out my environment and focus on the work at hand without intruding. Over time, I've learned to work to all kinds of other music. When I was writing The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, I worked to big band swing and Benny Goodman quartets and stuff like that. I do program the music to suit the project if I can. Sometimes it's weird things that work well, don't actually bear any obvious relation to the material that I'm working on, and yet somehow or other it's the right thing.
Well, I mean, you know, Juno Diaz was on the show not too long ago.
He's
and
so
basically
great.
Saying the same thing. You know, he can work to instrumental music, but he can only work to vocal music if he's already got the idea and he's now just working
You're not
the stuff
listening
out,
anymore, you know? Yeah.
So, for example, Amanda Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't write listening
that would
to
just,
her.
I don't think that could work. No, that would be too, I would be too busy paying
okay
attention.
For her to get married to Neil Gaiman in your house, but not okay to be on the stereo. That,
those were the
writing.
Terms of the agreement.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely. Yeah, no,
Amanda
it's
Palmer
weird.
Amanda Palmer later on the show today on Soundcheck. The idea of vocal music, instrumental music, it sort of goes to a big difference between Nat and Archie, the two guys who run the record store, and their sons. There's a little spoiler happening there.
Teenage boys. Yeah. Yes, Titus and Julie.
Julie listens to not just vocal music, but the kind of vocal music that you have already referenced. Yes, uh-huh. Prog rock.
Right.
Kansas, much to his dad's chagrin.
Yeah, Jethro Tull, but like weird late Jethro Tull, like Bungle in the Jungle. You know, I mean, for Julie, he has inherited his father's and Archie is a kind of uncle figure for Julie, someone he's known all his life. He has both inherited their tendency to valorize the art of the 1970s, like he's into blaxploitation movies and Kubrick films and you know, he recognizes the value in the stuff that his father and his friend Archie love, but he still has to find a way to rebel and annoy and irritate his father. And so he very cleverly sort of seizes on this one sort of genre of music that drives his father insane and yet is somehow also impeccably credentialed from the point of view of being from the proper decade.
But Kansas, yes. Were these your bands as a kid?
Well, I still love prog to this day, and unapologetically so. I mean, not. I mean, Kansas. Right. I mean, I got to admit, I have a little bit of a soft spot. And when "Carry On, My Wayward Son" comes on the radio, or "Point of No Return," it does stir some deep memories of going around the roller rink. You know, when I was 15 years old, trying to follow some girl, but. But a lot of the great prog from that period, King Crimson, the early Yes stuff, the early Genesis, some of the little more out there bands like Gentle Giant or Stackridge or Hatfield in the North and Soft Machine. I mean, that stuff, I still listen to it all the time. When I was a kid, I didn't like the more outre stuff that much. But, you know, it was much more about Yes and Genesis. And that stuff, I still like those early Yes albums, Fragile, Relayer, Close to the Edge, maybe above all, is just impeccably great music.
Now, Close to the Edge is referenced in passing,
yes,
in the book. But the song that you actually quote lyrics from is the song Portrait He Knew from the band Kansas. Portrait He Knew by the band Kansas from their 1977 album Point of No Return. That song is actually quoted, the lyrics, in Michael Chabon's new novel Telegraph Avenue, a book that is full of music, not necessarily this kind of music in terms of the two main protagonists,
right,
who like more of the soul jazz stuff, Michael, that we were talking about. I like that every time you mention a record, even when it is Point of No Return, in parentheses is the date and the record label. Even if you don't tell us who the artist was.
Mm-hmm, that's
Point
true.
Point of No Return appears, and it's like, I know that name. And like a few paragraphs later, it's like, this is Kansas he's talking about. It isn't until the next page that you actually identify the band.
When the father in horror says, "You're not listening to Kansas, are you?" Yeah. Yes. I mean, I have to say, first of all, that sounded pretty good to me.
Yeah.
Those guys could play their instruments, and, you know, electric violin and tricky time signatures can warm the heart of an old prog head.
So, you know, this the story of Telegraph Avenue is taking place. It's 2004. Cool. There are still record stores, you
right.
know.
Well, that was the
internet
thing.
Internet is coming.
Right.
It's looming.
Right.
Is owning a record store now an act of nostalgia, of like almost willful nostalgia?
I don't think it's nostalgia. I don't think it's an act of nostalgia. I think nostalgia is one of the impetuses for doing it. It's about love. It's an act of love. You have to love what you do. And, you know, if you love records, and there's ample reason to love records because they're great and they sound fantastic and they look good and they provide a multi-sensory experience that digital music's just never going to give you, even if it sounds wonderful. And of course, the best digital music, highest resolution, sounds very good indeed. But the combination of the full package with the photography, the typography, the liner notes, you know, the smell coming off the old cardboard, and then, you know, the music itself that sounds so wonderful on vinyl if you have an adequate system for playing it. It's you know, you are passionate about it, and you want other people to help share that passion and maybe make a little money off it. You're never going to be looking to make a killing. You know, records aren't going, knock on wood, they're not going away. There's, you know, I think I read that more vinyl records were sold last year, new ones, than in any year since the CD first emerged.
It certainly
like that.
Has made a big comeback.
Yeah, so, and our new store is opening as we speak on Telegraph Avenue in Oakland. A record store called Stranded Records is opening up now. I just accidentally stumbled on it before they opened, and you know, is it a quixotic thing to be doing? Possibly, but they must think they're going to be able to make a go of it.
We've been speaking with Michael Chabon. Telegraph Avenue is the name of his new novel, which is a sort of multi-sensory experience with the book cover that looks like a record, and
right.
of course the ebook with the accompanying playlist, which includes Johnny Hammond Smith and It's Too Late. This is another example of that kind of early 70s soul jazz
right.
that, Michael, you clearly feel passionate about, as you clearly do about lots of different forms of music. Thank you so much for sharing some of that with us
on Soundcheck
today.
Oh, it's been really fun for me, too. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.